Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing.
And Bubba Wallace.
You know what's the worst part of a race? A rain delay.
Sitting around, waiting for the track to dry, is dull.
But instead of waiting, we hang out with Chumba Casino.
Social casino slots, bingo, solitaire, plenty of fun to keep us entertained.
So why let a rain delay slow you down? Play now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Let's Chumba.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
KYW News Radio Original Podcasts. From KYW News Radio 103.9 FM, this is Bridging Philly, connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you. Presented by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org.
Hello, I'm Raquel Williams. Welcome to Bridging Philly. Americans have been engaged in the Battle of the Bulge for centuries. There are so many different weight loss tricks and trends. Some are safe, some are not. But the latest trend are GLP-1s, weight loss medications. Are these the next craze or a proven and effective way to finally combat obesity and treat it as a disease? We'll talk about it with two health professionals from Penn Medicine.
It's really just increasing your mindfulness of how you're using food, whether for positive or negative emotions.
And Charity Howard tells us all about Philly Pride 365.
We exist on every block and every corner of this city. And so that is where Pride exists.
All that's coming up on Bridging Philly. We are living in a society where body image is shaped by not just biology, but by algorithms, and where viral diets and workouts spread faster than facts. New medications like GLP-1s, they're reshaping the landscape of obesity treatment. At the same time, many people still battle eating disorders, and social media is amplifying unrealistic ideals. So now there's always been this battle of the bulge that we've been fighting, but with the addition of the new medications and the internet, the game has changed. Joining us for a discussion is Kelly Allison, director of University of Pennsylvania's Center for Weight and Eating Disorders, and also Sharon Leonard. She's a dietitian for Penn's clinical trials with GLP-1s. Welcome both of you to Bridging Philly.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
So let's first of all start off by where we are now. According to the CDC, the adult obesity rate in the United States is about 40.3%, with about 9.7% categorized as having severe obesity. Now, while adult rates have slightly plateaued in recent years, childhood and adolescent obesity rates have climbed to a record high of 21%. So I guess my first question to both of you, and you can both weigh in, what are some of the contributing factors to our rising obesity rate, especially among children and adolescents?
This is Kelly. I can take a stab at that first. We did see part of this trend of an uptick in obesity rates with COVID as physical activity plummeted during that time. And it seems that it's been hard to recover from that as children have become used to more screen time and less outside time. That is a big part of it. And then along with just our food environment has continued to be very challenging, and busy working families continue to rely on fast, you know, easy to grab foods that pack a bigger punch with calories. So those have continued to be challenges. I'll turn it over to Sharon.
Yeah, I agree with what Kelly said. And it's funny because it made me think of a conversation I literally just had maybe an hour ago with a patient who's considering participating in one of our trials. And she had said she lost weight about 65 pounds, close to 25% before COVID. And then when COVID, the restrictions had lifted, going back out to restaurants again, going to bars with friends, and she described it as having fun living again. It broke my heart to hear the conflict between having fun living again and a food environment, right? So trying to help patients to separate the two and have fun living again along with their health.
It's because we look at food. Food is a time to celebrate. You know, if something's great, you want to celebrate something, let's go out to eat. We associate, you know, celebrating, and even if, you know, hey, we got our freedom back, we can go out and do things again, we want to go out and eat. Unfortunately, I mean, I'm a big foodie too, and you know, weight is an issue, has been an issue my entire life. So, you know, this struggle I completely identify with. But maybe we need to kind of work on our relationship with food and how we look at things. You know, that kind of brings me to the question of mental health and looking at weight loss. Should we be looking at both? Because I figure that both are kind of connected. Either one can influence the other negatively or positively.
Absolutely. This is Kelly again, and this is a large part of my practice, is really just trying to understand the interplay between why we eat the way we eat. And often there are so many, you know, contributors with anxiety or depression or low self-esteem or problems with relationships that we use food to comfort ourselves. Food has often been used, and especially in eating disorders, it's used to focus on the food as a way to distract ourselves from those negative emotions. And the problem is it's effective, at least in the short term, is, you know, when you're eating and enjoying something, or even if it's mindless and it feels, in binge eating, let's say, where you're eating until you kind of stuff yourself and you get into a food coma, you're not thinking about the other things in life that are upsetting to you. You're focused on the food, but that's temporary. And then that feeling goes away, and then you're still stuck with those emotions that you really haven't fully processed, or the situation that you really haven't attended to. So part of this would be helping people understand the links between those, and instead of maybe avoiding those difficult emotions, finding ways to deal with them so that they're not displacing those negative feelings on the food. It can go the opposite way, as you said. Like, we also like to celebrate with food. And so, really, just trying to call to mind for ourselves, is the celebration the food itself? Or, you know, how much of that food do we really need to eat? Or how many of the foods at a party do we really need to try, you know, to make or break that experience for ourselves? And so, it's really just increasing your mindfulness of how you're using food, whether for positive or negative emotions. And how can we scale that back to be more consistent with our health goals?
Yeah, I can relate to that. Sharon, I see you're nodding your head there.
You know, I know this sounds ridiculous, but it makes me think of my sister's mashed sweet potatoes for Thanksgiving. Are her mashed sweet potatoes as delicious as they seem on Thanksgiving? Yes. Are they just as delicious next Thursday, right? On a just a regular Thursday? Or what I'm eating, is it not just the delicious food that I personally like, but is it also love, family, a holiday, the beautiful environment of all these foods? And it can become intoxicating. So because of that, you do again want to try to separate things and maybe dilute the power of food. When I talk to patients, I find myself included, a lack in hobbies that are not food related. And sometimes I wonder if, I don't wonder, I know that food is filling in many of those gaps, where hobbies would have taken the place previously, just like what Kelly was talking about. So maybe trying to find, help our patients and ourselves develop more pleasures, that it can help to dilute some of the power of food in areas where we don't want to be using them in the wrong way.
Let's talk about social media. There are a couple of ways that social media kind of affects, you know, how we look at food and how we look at ourselves, of course. In your practices and in dealing with patients and talking with people, how much do you think social media influences someone as far as how they look at their body and how they look at food?
Social media has really grown to be an outsized source of how people think about what is good for them, what's not good for them. I mean, you can look on any platform these days and find three different opinions on the same food. So it really just happens to be whatever pops up in your feed. And if you're taking that as, you know, the scientifically proven best food to be eating, because that's what one influencer says based on maybe personal experience, or maybe they're being sponsored by that food company. You know, you just really don't know where most of these folks are getting their information. But yet, people are living their lives based on whoever they happen to be following. And it's really disconcerting as a researcher and as a trained clinician, when people come in with ideas that they're, you know, really holding on to that really are not based on science. And I feel like a lot of this has undermined science. I think science in the nutritional realm has already been difficult to follow because it is so complex. And when people try in the social media realm to break it down and make it simpler, it doesn't necessarily make it more helpful because it may not be correct. And it, I think, leads people down rabbit holes of saying, oh, I should, I'm just picking this as an example, be vegan. And but maybe that's not good for them, or gluten-free when they have no issues with inflammation or gluten allergies. And then they're cutting out whole food groups from what they're eating and becoming very black and white about their thinking about foods. And that's generally what then leads to disordered types of thoughts about their bodies or body image, and that they're not keeping up with whoever they're trying to follow. So I think the simplicity of the message ends up maybe not following the science of what we know is out there that influences people to act in somewhat unhealthful ways.
It can be dangerous too. I mean, you're talking about things like the protein craze, or, you know, whatever craze is out there, people tend to overdo it. Oh, I need to have 50 cups of turmeric or whatever, whatever it is. There are so many of them out there, and they're so convincing that you need to do this and this is how it works. And then you end up in the emergency room. I mean, you could. So it can be dangerous too.
What's fascinating and what Kelly is saying is people automatically believe it is true, right? And then when it doesn't work or give them the effect that they're looking for, it can lead them down to feelings of despair and that nothing's going to work and there's no point in trying. And then the problem becomes amplified and snowballs. And then they start engaging in desperation tactics. And then round and round we go. So what Kelly described is what I described in my patients as people noise. And there's no shortage of it. And I wonder if we could get around some of that by borrowing from intermittent fasting, but fasting on, or really discerning what we allow to influence us and how much we'll consume, but not necessarily in food, but in social media, and who we're allowing to influence us and under what circumstances, by what evidence.
Now, you said people noise, which made me think of food noise, Sharon. So we're definitely going to delve into the GLP-1 conversation, you know, and I'm thinking back to a time when doctors used to say to me, hey, if there was a pill or a shot for people to lose weight, everybody's going to take it. Are we here? Is this where we are now?
There's many people who definitely want the medication, but I would say the vast majority of people who come in on day one in our studies, they want the medication to get them to the next step, but the large majority don't want to stay on it. They want to be not dependent on a medication, and these medications can be very hard to come off of. It doesn't mean there's not hope. So I would say yes to both things. I think we're going to see it continue to blow up in society. But it's nice that it's available for people that are, they've just had it now with trying to do it themselves.
Okay.
They feel spent. So it's joyous, truly joyous to see the relief people get and the self-esteem that comes back and the pleasure being able to have a meal in front of friends and not be choking on every bite because they feel self-conscious of what they're eating, how they're perceived in front of the company. What's the calorie cost of the foods they're eating? It's just lovely to see people enjoy a meal with the people they love again.
So let's talk about it. Let's explain to us exactly what GLP-1s are and what they're doing in the body to help people lose weight.
GLP-1 receptor agonists were originally purposed for controlling glucose levels in people with diabetes. So it does help the pancreas increase insulin production when we eat. They are naturally produced in our body, but they only act momentarily, right? They're very short-lived in their natural state in our bodies. And so they certainly promote satiety and, you know, when you're eating, so naturally that happens, but then it passes very quickly. What we have in these medications is a manufactured version that is much greater in intensity, and they've, you know, been manufactured now to last much longer. So the injectables that we have last about a week. The pill forms now that we have that are FDA, more recently FDA approved, last, you know, a shorter half-life. You take those every day. But it's still much, the staying power, the half-life is much longer than what occurs naturally in the body. It does cross the blood-brain barrier. And so in the brain, there's many receptors in many different parts of our brain for GLP. And so we do see that reduced attention to food, what's been commonly called now as food noise, that the field is still really trying to define. It also acts to slow down the rate that our food is digested. It's naturally occurring in the small intestine. And so that's where it generally would help slow down the digestive process. And that makes us feel full faster on with smaller amounts of food. So that's the broad way of how it works.
Okay. So that makes sense. And, you know, maybe we can explain food noise when people hear that. I know what the food noise is because I experience it. I read about it and I'm like, oh my goodness, I definitely experienced the food noise. Can you elaborate a little bit about what the food noise is so people understand?
Yeah. So it's really what you hear people talk about is they're thinking about food, maybe even after they've eaten a regular sized meal. They're thinking about what they're going to eat next. They're thinking about how it tasted. They're thinking about the negative effects that they might be perceiving from it and the weight that it might cause them to gain. They're worried. They're happy. They're enjoying the flavor profile. They're just constantly thinking about it, intrusive thoughts that they don't necessarily want to be happening. And it's kind of, in the end, stealing the joy from the food. Just kind of a preoccupation that feels exhaustive. And then again, it sends people down that chain of events of feeling demoralized because it makes them then self-conscious. And what's wrong with me that I am thinking about food so much? How come my friend who's not struggling with their weight, how come they're not thinking about food all the time? If I'm sitting down at lunch with that person, am I eating too fast? Am I eating too much? Should I be picking something else? All these things that are taking away the joy of the company that they're in, all of these thoughts that are taking away the joy of the food they're eating, when someone else who's not experiencing that might just be enjoying the company and eating the food.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly, connecting our communities on the issues that matter to you.
GLP-1s are short-lived, so people have to be on them for the duration of time that they want to lose weight or for a lifetime if they want to keep the weight off. How does that work?
There is evidence in both clinical trials and in observational studies that when people discontinue these medications, they do regain weight. On average, by about a year and a half, most people regain most of their weight. And the associated improvements that they might have had in blood pressure and other health indices also then deteriorate as they regain the weight, unfortunately. A lot of times when people are taking these medications, if they've reached the top dose after about a year, year and a half, maybe even closer to 2 years, they start to say, I'm not sure this is really doing anything for me anymore. It doesn't feel as powerful. I feel physically hungry more. I have some of that food noise coming back. And what we know from some of our research too, but also from clinical experience, when people do stop the meds still are doing something for them. It's just not as powerful maybe as it was in the very beginning. They are able to eat a little bit more. They are thinking about food a bit more, but it is really helping them maintain the weight that they've lost on those meds. And they see that if they do go off, it is a big contrast. Those thoughts of food come back. They're not as full as they were when they were on the medication. So it's really hard to stop at the portions they had been eating previously. It's just hard. It's just such a big contrast because it's not like your body then says, oh, they've stopped the injections or they stopped taking the pills. I'm going to, you know, fill in that gap and make more GLP myself. It just doesn't work that way. You take it away and those thoughts of food come back and you feel hungrier and you're not as satisfied as early in your meal. Like those things are real and those are really hard to deal with all of a sudden.
I'm wondering if there's, and I know this is fairly new and, you know, we're seeing a lot of ads for this and we're learning a lot more about it. Is there some kind of a bridge that it can exist for people who want to come off of it, but also want to learn how to eat better, perhaps coming off of it and hooking up with a nutritionist or something like that, where you can have lifetime coaching instead of, you know, being on the medication for a lifetime, so to speak? Something else we can do to, now that we've seen the results, here's how you can maintain it.
The way in is the way out, is what I'll say. Before we had these meds, the top of the line for weight management, as in like a stepped care, would be, of course, portion control, then maybe calorie counting and food records. But as you escalate for more efficacy and having to think less about it, That's where you might get into like Optifast or Nutrisystem, you know, ways to not have to think too much about what you're eating. You know, you have it already scripted. So that can help as the top of the level before meds. But now if you're trying to come off, that's what I would say for coming off that might make it easier, getting into a really intensive behavior therapy program that may or may not include prepackaged meals like Nutrisystem or protein shakes and protein bars and things like that, or SlimFast, something like that, coupled with a specialized provider to implement intensive behavior therapy, which would be defined as 14 visits over 6 months, and helping people understand, how do I know this is working? Not just working by the scale as the evidence, but as in, is this working in my life? Is this sustainable?
Okay. So wanted to talk about safety. Obviously, we see the efficacy. We see people are successful on these. How safe is it, and who is eligible to be on GLP-1s?
You know, when we think about the history of weight management medications, we've had some really not safe ones, unfortunately. And I think it took a while for the medical community to embrace these, which now obviously has happened because of our past experience with that. You know, these have been on the market in various forms since 2014, when they were originally FDA approved for diabetes. And so even though they're newer for obesity care, and that the doses are higher for obesity care than they originally were for diabetes management, we still do have like a nice track record of their safety. Now, there are some exclusions, medullary thyroid cancer, a family history of that. We would not recommend it, like if people have had various GI issues. And these would be things you would talk with your physician about. And I will mention eating disorders. There's less evidence about exactly what type of eating disorders or when somebody has had an eating disorder that you might, you know, want to consider whether or not this is the best treatment for them. But in particular, if somebody has had anorexia or bulimia, where restriction has really been a big part of their disease, that you really want to consider, would this be triggering for that, in the fact that they lose their hunger signals a lot of times? And a lot of the work we do with eating disorders care is to get people back in touch with their hunger signals and to nourish their body as needed. You know, these medications might take that away again and trigger this restriction, and then trigger also, oh, I'm losing weight. It's not enough. And we do see this in some of folks who seek care at our center too, is that they start losing so much weight, and then, you know, they're at a very low BMI and they don't want to give that up, even though it's not safe for them. So that would be, I think, the darker side of use of these medications. And unfortunately, people can go to, you know, these online cares and pharmacies with compounding agents and make up a weight and not even have to go see anybody and not meet the BMI criteria. People are getting these from all over the place at this point, which is a real problem. It's like whack-a-mole. There's been no way that our government or regulatory agencies have been able to keep up with so far.
Yeah, there's so much stuff out there, the patches, the natural GLPs, all kinds of things. It's just mind-boggling. But I read an article that said, and let me know if you agree with this, if we're giving GLP-1s to our children, we've already failed them. Our children, should they be off limits when it comes to GLP-1s?
You know, I've been involved with our bariatric program for a couple of decades, right? And CHOP, our children's hospital, has a bariatric program for adolescents 16 and up. And, you know, across the country, there are very thoughtful people, right, that have established these programs and set these up and now are working on the guidelines for medications for kiddos with higher weight. There's a lot of kids who are presenting with a lot of what were formerly adult illnesses. So if we think that giving them a GLP-1 is a worse alternative than having them have sleep apnea and hypertension, fatty liver disease at 15 and 16, and letting them live life without an intervention, I don't see that as a failure. I see that as, let's help these kids, right? And I don't know whether it's, you know, likely a multi-determined reason that we see folks at these kids at these higher weights who are having these medical issues. But I don't also just want to leave them hanging and say, we know you're longevity is at risk because of these, and you're going to feel different from all of your peers because you can't do the things that they can do, and you're sicker and going to see your doctors more. You know, let's give them what we have to help them when they are at those higher weights.
Sharon, what do you think?
I really agree. And I have the highest compassion for our patients, not just the adults, but the little ones, right? I know as an adult who is a dietitian who specializes in weight management, how hard impulse control and people noise is as an adult. Goodness, that's an awful lot to ask of a little one. And I would say, wouldn't we give that child blood pressure medicine if they needed it? I don't see why we won't want to help them with the tools that we have. But the tools with GLPs aren't just giving a medication. It's also helping to reformat the relationship with food for people, helping people reformat their relationship with the scale so that it's not the end all be all, but it's an evidence of the direction is going, the effort that you're putting through is working, but also the relationship with yourself so that you feel comfortable in your own skin. You can see the beauty and the goodness in you, and you can facilitate your health goals in a way that's sustainable and gives life, but not just life as in what you're eating, but the fullness of life.
So what are some of the more common side effects of GLP-1s in general?
Well, the obvious ones are the GI-related side effects, which would be nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, reflux. And that sounds scandalous and sounds terrible, but people don't get all those at the same time, and they don't get them with a high intensity, usually, right? Because you usually start off low and slow, and you monitor the person's tolerance to it. Usually the side effects are tolerable, and your body, which I would have never believed unless I had the job I do, I would have never believed your body can get used to side effects, and then you don't feel them anymore, and then you can move up to the next dose. And what's fascinating and also a little bit sad is some people, when they're in a research study, they get excited when they feel nauseous, right? They're not sad. They're not upset about it. They're excited because that means they're on the real drug and not the placebo. But what makes me sad about that is a testament to the what it means to them and what the struggle that they've gone through, that nausea is worth it, right? So I am all for how we can give relief to people in a way that gives them life and gives them the love and respect that they deserve.
I'm happy to see that the medical industry is finally moving away from, you know, you eat too much, you need to have more willpower, and really trying to treating obesity as a chronic disease, and that there's just so much that goes into it. But there's the stigma still exists, whether you're on a GLP-1 or you're not on a GLP-1. Oh, you cheated. Oh, you had surgery, or you took a drug, or you cheated.
Yes.
You didn't do it the right way. I mean, it's still, it doesn't matter what people do. There's still that cloud, that stigma that's out there. If you could just comment on that. I mean, does it really matter how people get to the point of being healthy or not?
I think that our society was making up some ground on body positivity, and if not that, then body neutrality, and helping people really understand that people do come in all shapes and sizes. And while these meds have brought great relief to so many people, at the same time, I think it's really, as the society brought us backwards, to value that thin ideal. I think that's been one of the unintended side effects. And absolutely, people feel stigma for taking these meds. They feel judged. They may not want to tell other people that they're on them to avoid that kind of stigma. I'm hopeful that over time, people will take in that this is a chronic disease. And I do think there is some progress towards that. It's just been very slow. But I think that there's also this side damage now that everybody then should, quote unquote, should be able to take these and lose weight and not have higher weight. And I don't think that's the right way to think about it either, because, yeah, not everybody can tolerate them. Not everybody can afford them. And not everybody, you know, medically, is it safe for them to take them? There's all kinds of reasons why not 100% of people with high weight, you know, should be taking these. But I think our society likes to keep things simple and judge other people, unfortunately, for their body shape and size. And this has given people another angle to do that, unfortunately.
Yeah. Sharon?
I agree. And on a larger scale, this is what I'll say to patients. I would ask the question, why does it matter what these people are saying? What is the evidence that what they're saying is even true? But why do they matter specifically to you? So I'd really want to build up the patient that I am helping, because people noise, it's not just selective to food and the food environments and weight and body image, but it's, I mean, look, we teach, going back to children, we teach children how not to be susceptible to peer pressure when they're little. Those things don't change suddenly as we're an adult, right? So we have to be learning and relearning and supporting one another in groups that we choose to walk in. And the key word is there is choose, right? We get to choose who we listen to. We get to choose what influencing we consume, or we can fast on it. We can borrow from intermittent fasting and take a pause on those people, persons, places, and things.
Gotcha. Got you. All right. Well, obviously, this is a decision at the end of the day between patient and doctor, and everyone can make whatever decision they feel is best for them without judgment, hopefully. Thank you so much for your time. But tell us how we can get to learn more about the work that you're both doing at Penn.
Yeah, we're at the Center for Weight and Eating Disorders, and we do publish a lot of our work, but we do have our website as well. You can search for Center for Weight and Eating Disorders, and we will pop up. And we also offer clinical trials, as Sharon has been describing, as well as therapy services for folks with weight and eating issues.
All right. Well, sounds good. Kelly Allison and Sharon Leonard, thank you so much for lending your expertise and really explaining things, because there's just so much misinformation out there. I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you. It was fun.
Bridging Philly continues in a moment. Back to Bridging Philly from KYW News Radio 103.9 FM.
Philly Pride 365 is back, and it's expected to be bigger than ever. Bigger Pride flag, bigger festival grounds, bigger crowds. Charity Howard takes us there on this latest Shara in the City.
This week on Shara in the City, we're celebrating Pride under the banner of Pride is Power with Philly Pride 365's Tyrell Brown, who's been at the top of most LGBTQ+ conversations, some good, some not so good, talking about the changes to the annual Pride Festival. And on a brighter rainbow note, an amazing lineup, starting with Patti LaBelle, who will be honored with a special award on the day of the festival. And wait, don't stop now. We're also going to help kick off Pride Month at the official Sofitel Philadelphia with a string of Philly LGBTQ+ local celebrities, if you will. Advocacy is celebrity in Philly. But first, we're heading to Tyrell Brown's house and home for a coffee chit chat. Cream and sugar, baby. Let's go.
Hey, Shara.
Hey, Ty. How are you?
Good. Come on in.
So let's get started. Pride 365 this year is going to be bigger than ever.
Yes. I mean, it's getting bigger each and every year.
But then straight to the controversy, the big move.
That's right. We are really excited to share that the festival is not just moving, it's expanding. I think that's the different context that people are missing. We're not leaving the gayborhood behind. We are strategically partnering with partners in the gayborhood, Washington West Civic Association, as well as the new Pride Visitor Center and all the gayborhood businesses, to make sure that they are getting the economic impact that we've provided since 2022 for these large-scale events. In addition to that, the large-scale festival simply outgrew the gayborhood. Like, I mean, kudos to our community for showing up and showing out. You just can't fit 150,000 people in those streets. Even if you expand to Walnut Street, as we did last year, it just simply is not plausible. So part of that was the reason why we moved over to the Parkway. I mean, that space is made for large-scale events, right? Especially for people who have accessibility needs. It's one of the core pieces of speaking with Disability Pride. It's not just safety, it's security. I think that's where the distinction there, right? Clear sight lines, we're able to put a perimeter fencing around it. We also can control for economic impact for the bars that will be there. We're inviting the gayborhood bars to set up satellite locations.
And Tyrell also addressed the fact that people are really upset that it's not going to be in the gayborhood. He said this.
I want to make this, underline this. We exist on every block and every corner of this city. And so that is where Pride exists. It's not just in the gayborhood. It is in every block of every city. When we say that we exist on every block, that's why we do Pride around the city.
And the history component. There's a lot there.
As there's more visibility, as we still continue to grow and continue to provide platforms for people to grow, I think, like, it's our our duty to not just like show up, but also how do we show up? How do we support each other through these processes? It doesn't come easily, doesn't come without tension. It doesn't come without challenging ourselves to grow and think about things a little bit differently. That historical context in years past, Pride has been, how did it grow? It was also at one time down, what, Judy Garland Park, as we call it, right? It was down there. There was one time when it was on Broad and Washington before they built the building there with Target and Sprouts. It was there one year. And then it was also traditionally down at Penn's Landing.
Oh, yeah. And you'll need a ticket this year. The price, $10 a pop.
Yes, ticketing this year will be happening because we wanted to make the event sustainable. Costs are through the roof. And we also did a giving campaign in November to make sure that we could mitigate costs as much as we could. And I want to make this clear and underline it. There are still avenues for free access. The $10 entry fee is for those who have the economic ability to do that because we were never going to shut or cut anyone out of Pride.
So what's the lineup?
We have panel discussions, poetry slam. We have tons of programming, Pride around the region, which is we're going to take our now 1,000-foot Pride flag around the Tri-County area to strategic locations. That will be, I believe, on Monday throughout the week. And then on Friday, we're doing Pride around the city. So we'll be stopping at locations all over the city like we've done for the past several years. And then our new initiative and event that we dreamed up this year, so that way, as I expressed, so that way we didn't leave the gay bar behind, but we were bringing it with us, is on Saturday. And that will be from 4 to 8. In the neighborhood. So it's really a intentional 21 plus support our gay businesses directly event, show up, but also support the people that are routinely supporting us.
And then Sunday?
And then Sunday on the parkway, we start in the morning with our march that will be leaving from the neighborhood and heading over there. And then the festival starting at noon and ending at 7 on the parkway with a bang.
Okay, and when he says bang, he means full-on Philly icon. Now, who is it?
Patty. It's Patty Shaw.
Big things.
Yes, big things as usual for Philly Pride 365. Leveling it up again this year. A lot of changes, but one of the biggest and most amazing changes that we have, Patty LaBelle will be joining us to celebrate Pride with our community on the parkway. We are really proud and honored to be able to be in a position to honor her and her contributions, support, love for the community here in Philadelphia, especially in this pinnacle year of the semi-quincentennial.
So we went on a walkabout around Philly, the neighborhood in particular, to hear just how people are feeling about all the changes, but also to really talk about the future of Philly's LGBTQ communities. It really is about plus is a must. And no small stuff. We started out big with Jason Bowman. He is truly a legend here in Philly in ballroom, but also in activism. So we caught up with him at the Sofitel Philadelphia official Pride kickoff.
Happy Pride.
Let's talk about it. Today was really special. Why?
It was special because you had an opportunity to see a lot of the change makers and leaders across the city come together for something that we care so deeply about, and that's Pride. Pride is something that is not just a celebration. It's an act of protest. It's a resistance. It's also something that brings the city of Philadelphia on one day, but our survival and visibility has to last and be 365 days. Even in those small, dark corners where everybody doesn't feel seen, celebrated, and more tolerated, it's about bringing those people out of the darkness into the light.
I love it. Endurance for assurance.
Hello.
And another one of those community icons, Sheila Alexander Reed from PHL Diversity. She hyped up the crowd and then she gave a little perspective. Thanks, Sheila.
Philadelphia is ready. Are you ready?
Yes. This is not just raising a flag. This is raising hope. This is not just a gay thing. This is an everybody thing.
It's a we thing.
Yes.
And Brittany Lynn, Philly famous drag queen, was hostess with the mostest.
Did you see? This was wall-to-wall legends. Like, talk about Philadelphia royalty. Everybody from Jace to Rue. Like, we're not stepping back. We're moving forward.
Then it was time to hit the streets. We had to hear what the people were talking about. How do they feel about all the changes? All right. So, hey, how you doing? What's your name?
Good. I'm Lance. How are you?
Lance, nice to meet you.
Hello.
So what does your pride look like?
You know, you can't not host it in neighborhood. Like, what other spot can you host Pride? I think the parkway and charging for it too is a little, I do my walkthrough to say I, you know, see all my friends and my people, And then we end up at like someone's rooftop or something. Always. That's usually what we do. That's our go-to.
What do you do to celebrate? Your name?
Yeah, absolutely. Joseph Rich. When you think about what we have locally, things go on all month, but we get one big celebration where we get to see all of our friends. You get to cross paths with people all day long on that Pride Sunday. And for me, it's about, while it's important to uplift the gay community as a whole,
yeah,
we have to make sure that it starts at home.
And the interconnectedness is so real here in Philly.
It really is.
There's so many layers.
You know, what do people say? The world gets smaller every day. We're interconnected on a way where you pass one gay person in Philly, they know another gay person that you know.
Yes.
And then it all goes around.
We know how that works. Ding, ding, ding. Yeah. So let's talk about the festival, all the changes. How do you feel about it?
My first Pride ever was when it was at Penn's Landing.
Yeah.
It was okay. But I liked for the past, what was it, 5 years that we had Pride here in the Gayborhood.
Are you excited about Patti LaBelle? She's getting the Love Honor Award.
Oh, I didn't know that. But that's me not
She's
doing
be the
all
main...
of my research. See, they were right a little bit.
My name is Marquise Boykin.
Happy Pride.
Happy Pride. Thank you.
So what does your Pride look like?
So this is my first Pride here in Philly.
Amazing.
So I'm excited. My Pride is going to look like going out, hanging with friends, doing all the rainbow activities. I'm trying to get everything in because, like, this is my first one. And, like, you know, we only get a month. And it's also Juneteenth, too. So, like, I'm just trying to mix everything in. Everyone's been telling me I have to hit up the parade. Oh, yes. I like a little mess.
Don't we all?
So I'm down. Yeah, I'm excited for the festival and for all the activities and, like, going to Tavern, Bar X, the little gay pub.
All the tries and trues. All together, it really comes down to one thing. Community.
It's important to make sure that we're honing in on keeping our community thriving.
I mean, with everything that's going on in the world, I think it's more important to get out and just be around people that's like-minded and just enact change.
And what about the addition of Patti LaBelle at Pride?
Patti, she's the queen of Philly.
She's for the gays, the girls and the gays, and the theys.
That's it. You heard it here, Philly. Happy Pride.
Thank you for joining us. Bridging Philly is brought to you by Gift of Life Donor Program. Register as an organ donor at donorsone.org. For more information on Bridging Philly, follow KYW News Radio on social media. And if you have any ideas for interesting features that you'd like to share, feel free to get in touch with us at bridgingphilly@kywnewsradio.com. For Sharaday Howard and our producer Sabrina Boyd-Circa, I'm Raquel Williams. Be well.